This coming Wednesday, November 20th, will mark the 68th year since the beginning of the war crimes trials at the end of World War II. These Nuremberg trials saw aggressive war not only as an international crime, but as the supreme international crime, for it contains all the other crimes of war. And the charter of the newly formed United Nations saw as its primary objective to maintain or restore international peace and security. But the result has been quite contrary to the noble objective. Indeed, the United Nations developed new excuses for waging wars of aggression, particularly as the United States sought to establish itself as the sole global superpower. To discuss wars of aggression and the excuses for waging them, I'm joined in the studio by Derek O'Keefe. Derek is co-chair of the Canadian Peace Alliance, author of several books, including one on Michael Ignatieff, another an autobiography co-written with Malalai Joya. He also is a broadcaster on Vancouver Cooperative Radio and a prominent social justice activist. Good morning, Derek, and thanks for coming down to the station this morning.
Good morning, Mordecai. Always great to be here and on Reda.
Wars in recent years, if we think back on the Balkans, Iraq, Afghanistan, Libya, and others, tumble forth, it seems, one after another. Do you get any sense that these war makers regard their actions as the supreme international crime?
Quite the opposite. I think they regard it as supremely unfortunate that the peoples of these countries, Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, didn't get it together to take advantage of their noble generosity in invading them. If you look through a lot of the literature, going back, in fact, to Michael Ignatieff's prominent apology, quote-unquote, for his support for the Iraq War, it was really an effort in blaming the Iraqi people for not being able to pull together a post-invasion government that was stable. And the literature of these war makers tends in this direction, of really making excuses for their mistakes. I would say they have a relationship to their past war making in a similar way to Rob Ford takes responsibility to his past actions. He's like, oh, well, yeah, you just found out about this other crazy thing I did and terrible thing I did, but I'm taking responsibility and all I can do is look forward, move forward. It's really the complete opposite of accountability. It's just on to the next noble intervention.
So one's comic and the other's tragic, but the same pattern. Would you like to elaborate a bit more on the kind of rationales that the war makers use to disguise their aggression? What cloak do they put on these acts, which are, as we know in retrospect, are utterly disastrous?
Well, there's a major debate, I would say, in Canadian elite circles or ruling circles about how best to frame an aggressive foreign policy. There's sort of the more hawkish, conservative point of view that says we just talk about Canada needing to be more aggressive on the international stage, becoming a warrior nation. You know, this effort by the Harper government to celebrate all past wars, going all the way back to glorifying the War of 1812, linking it to the need for a more aggressive foreign policy today. And this tendency in the ruling circles is obviously in power in Canada right now and puts less weight on multilateral interventions, just talks more about Canada's role as a war maker and building up its capacity to fight. The more dominant traditionally trend in the ruling elite has been a more liberal imperialist rhetoric, and the recent jargon around this is the responsibility to protect doctrine that was advocated while he was in government by Foreign Minister Lloyd Axworthy and drafted in part by Michael Ignatieff as part of an international commission. The responsibility to protect was invoked or made up, let's say, by these liberal interventionists in a commission led by the former Australian Prime Minister Gareth Evans in 2001. And the reason they needed to rebrand the liberal rhetoric around going to war was that the Kosovo invasion by NATO, the bombing of Serbia in 1999, did not receive UN approval, so it was illegal under international law. And it also mobilized widespread opposition, particularly in the global south, where the majority of the world's people live and the majority of world governments spoke out in one way or another against the Kosovo War. And the Kosovo War was put forward as a glorious humanitarian intervention. And I think when that when they failed to get an international consensus around that, the liberal wing of the war makers wanted to have a new doctrine, and that's where they came up with responsibility to protect.
And was that, I mean, the rhetoric of that is you're actually doing a humanitarian service. You're concerned with people's lives and existence, and so you want to protect them. Were there wars that that doctrine could have been applied, but never was? And in a sense, the contradiction between avowing a humanitarian objective, but applying it in such arbitrary ways undercut the credibility of that rhetoric.
Yeah, I think that's always a game in play. There are some liberal imperialists who really believe in the rhetoric, but I would say they're a minority who full on believe in the rhetoric. I think many others, including Michael Ignatieff, recognize the contradictions of it. They recognize that he has written in the past that it will always be applied hypocritically, because really we're only talking about the big powers intervening. So, I mean, Libya is a very good case study for all of this, because actually the responsibility to protect doctrine hadn't been spoken about as confidently by its advocates in recent years. The whole idea of intervening and going to war had been badly damaged by the Iraq debacle. You could say that the war makers had an Iraq syndrome. They used to talk about the Vietnam syndrome that made it harder for the U.S. to intervene. So around Libya, one op-ed writer in the Toronto Star, I think, said that the Libya intervention breathed life into the idea of responsibility to protect. Because the justification for the initial UN resolution authorizing force was that there was an immediate danger of a massacre in Benghazi of protesters by the Gaddafi government, and that this intervention and a no-fly zone was needed to stop that. Now, almost from the moment, in fact, from the moment they passed that UN resolution, they had gone beyond the strict definition of responsibility to protect and the strict rationale of preventing this massacre that they said was imminent. But they went much, much further than NATO powers, and primarily the UK, the US, and France, almost immediately began talking as if they were conducting a regime change operation. And this very much upset Russia and China, who had abstained at the UN, but hadn't really used their power on the Security Council to block this resolution. So there you had a dispute amongst the big powers, but also you had this dispute or debate amongst the advocates of responsibility to protect. And we can see it even in the debates in Canada about the Libya intervention. So for instance, Elizabeth May, who in June 2011 cast the sole vote, very shamefully the only vote against extending the military intervention in Libya, her argument, in fact, was that the initial no-fly zone was legitimate under the responsibility to protect, but that all further intervention leading towards a regime change and massive bombing. By the way, we should say the NATO bombing in Libya claimed tens of thousands of victims, most of them civilians. So, but her claim was couched, even her anti-war claim was couched in this responsibility to protect doctrine. So I hope I'm being clear there. And there are really tactical debates amongst people in our political circles who fundamentally agree it's okay to intervene aggressively into another country's affairs. And that's a big political vacuum, I guess, that we have in terms of an anti-war perspective in Canada and in many of the other NATO countries as well.
What then would you say, in just stripped of all rhetoric, what is the underlying motivation for all these wars of aggression?
Well, I've been thinking about World War I, actually, because next year is the 100-year anniversary of the First World War. And the UK government and the Harper government are going to spend millions of dollars celebrating this centennial of a mass slaughter. Of course, we know the motivation for World War I was competition amongst empire. Not to you know, not to say that Libya and even Iraq are on the same scale as a world conflagration like that, but really what we're talking about is capitalism. Jean Jaurès, the French socialist who opposed World War I and was assassinated just days before the outbreak of hostilities, he had a great quote about capitalism. He said, "Capitalism contains within itself war like clouds contain rain." So I think the underlying motivation, the motivation changes from intervention to intervention, but ultimately what we're talking about is an economic and a ruling political system that has to expand. Markets have to expand, and one of the best ways to expand the reach of capital is to build up militaries. One, because you can go in and free up new markets, capture new resources, but also just from the military production itself. So here in Canada, one of the so I guess war is its own motivation in some sense when you're living under a capitalist system. And getting back to that idea of a political vacuum in truly opposing militarism in Canada, if you look at the case of the shipbuilding, the war, the warships, which we now find out are tens of billions of dollars over budget. They're going to cost $100 billion altogether. Well, the opposition parties are in a very weak position to oppose this because they green-lighted and went along with the warship building program all along. So I guess, you know, you can get a lot of intelligent intellectuals to create or to justify, to create justifications for specific interventions based on the conditions in Libya, Afghanistan, or Iraq. But fundamentally, what you're talking about is a global system that needs to go to war, that wants to go to war, continue to expand.
The first place, it seems, the country where the humanitarian war-making rationale, the fact that you're doing it for the good of the population that you're bombing, fell apart, failed, was Syria. It was unable to follow the plan that had been laid out by the Americans, by the British, etc. It collapsed in Britain. And I'm wondering what you attribute that failure to, because it's in the decades since the end of Second World War, that is the major place where the strategy of rebranding, of re-rationalizing, collapsed.
Well, if we say that Libya put the wind in the sails of the responsibility to protect doctrine, then Syria maybe took some of that wind out or represented the a break on that momentum that they had, let's put it that way. I think a big part of it was the Iraq syndrome, and this was manifest most evidently in the UK, where Prime Minister David Cameron made what now appears to be a tragic mistake of thinking he could go, like all former British prime ministers have done, to Parliament and get a rubber stamp on his plan to go to war with the Americans. And the UK Labour Party decided to oppose this, the largest opposition party. But also David Cameron had a major rebellion in his own Conservative Party. And he ended up being humiliated and defeated in this vote in Parliament for war. So I think there are a number, and the vote in the UK sort of set off a chain reaction, where here in Canada, for instance, it was brought up at least, why isn't Harper debating this in Parliament? Because Harper was going around saying he supported calls for intervention into Syria. In the United States, Obama decided he needed to go to Congress to get approval. And then, of course, it was quite evident that he wasn't going to get that approval. So, but I think in terms of the political factors, why they hit a wall in trying to intervene in Syria, there's a few. The first is Iraq syndrome, as I've mentioned. The other is just the continuation of anti-war organizing. In the UK in particular, the Stop the War Coalition has maintained an infrastructure and an activism that probably, unfortunately, is not rivaled in North America or the rest of Europe. So they've done a good job, and they've been serious about maintaining that anti-war base of activity. For instance, they have the prominent involvement of Labour MPs, such as Jeremy Corbyn and a number of others. Even when the Labour Party was in power, they had the involvement of Labour MPs in their anti-war coalition. So just they had more political sway. Other factors are less promising, let's say. There's also just major geopolitical limitations to intervention, and that's nothing really to celebrate for the anti-war movement. I'm speaking specifically about Russia's role in backing the Syrian regime. Clearly, Russia was upset about what happened in Libya, and also Syria represents their only naval base outside of the Russian borders. So they're very serious about maintaining an ally there, and so they blocked any Security Council approval. And again, nothing to celebrate, because we know what the Putin regime is about.
Well, there's much more to be said on this subject, and we'll try and arrange a time to continue the discussion. Thanks for coming in this morning, Derek.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
I've been speaking with Derek O'Keefe. He's co-chair of the Canadian Peace Alliance, author of several books, including one on Michael Ignatieff and another, an autobiography co-written with Malalai Joya. And Derek also is a broadcaster on Vancouver Cooperative Radio and a prominent social justice activist.